you're a little scary sometimes. You know that. Brilliant. Scary.
You're listening to Voxic Shock, because ignorance won't save you.
A financial panic gripped the world.
I decided, if it's all right with you, to appoint myself morale officer.
This will be the madness for Britain.
Those memories of fear are coming back.
I don't care what anybody says about the new world order. I don't trust that guy.
He has no idea what it's like out there. None!
Now here's Vox Day. V-O-X-D-A-Y. Pronounced...
Oh, ah!
Today's show shouldn't be too scary because we're going to keep it on the theoretical side. Ian Fletcher is the author of Free Trade Doesn't Work. I tracked him down while he was en route from DC to California to ask him a few questions about his book. I was quite fascinated with your book, Free Trade Doesn't Work, and in fact, I gave it 5 out of 5 stars.
Thank you.
When most people think of opposition to free trade, they think of three things. They think of the 18th century mercantilists that were supposedly routed by Adam Smith and David Ricardo. They think of the UAW opposing cheap Japanese cars in the 1970s. And they think of Pat Buchanan and his pitchfork populism in the 1988 presidential campaign. How are the arguments you put forward in Free Trade Doesn't Work distinguished from those three things?
Well, you've got to remember that those three examples you gave all consist of people who are, for one reason or another, disreputable in some way and to some currents of opinion, but they were also people who did have a point. Mercantilism, for example, is not just something from the 18th century. It goes back to the very dawn of modern capitalism and the Renaissance. You have to remember that that global trade is not something that was invented in 1990. It's been going back hundreds of years, back to the era when it was conducted with sailing ships. And very shortly after international capitalism began to take shape, various nations and their governments started to learn that there were enormous advantages to be derived from gaming the system. And surprise, surprise, this is still going on. It's what China is doing today. It's what Japan has done for decades. And to some extent, it's what the United States itself used to do for most of its history. For example, for most of its history, the United States was very explicitly a tariff-protected economy. The founding fathers were protectionists, for example. The economist among the founding fathers is Alexander Hamilton, the guy on the $10 bill, and he wrote a report entitled A Report on Manufactures, which he submitted to Congress in 1791, in which he laid out a rationale for protectionism that still holds good today. Hamilton was a very smart guy. Among other things, you might be surprised to learn that he is the inventor of the R&D tax credit, which he proposed in 1791.
I had no idea. I knew he was big on central banks. I didn't realize he was up on tax credits as well.
Yeah, so the point is that mercantilism is not something that was blown out of the water by Adam Smith, who was in many ways, although he was a brilliant guy, he was also the servant of various economic interests in his own time, particularly the economic interests of the Scots, who had their own quarrels with the English. And Adam Smith is not a fully reliable guide in the sense that everything he said was true. And you mentioned David Ricardo. One of the interesting things about Ricardo is if you actually go back and read his original book, in which he enunciated for the first time the theory of comparative advantage, you discover that he says things like, well, I have this theory, and one of the provisos to this theory is that if you have international mobility of capital, well, then my theory that free trade is always your best move ceases to be true.
Joseph Schumpeter is extremely harsh on Ricardo's manner of constructing arguments. He said that Keynes and Ricardo actually had a lot in common in that way.
Well, there's any number of problems with Ricardo. You have to remember that Ricardo is writing in the early 19th century. I mean, his main book came out in 1817. So to some extent, I can forgive him for the fact that a lot of his reasoning is, by present-day standards, exceedingly primitive. He was also someone who, among his other great discoveries, was the so-called iron law of wages, according to which basically you can never help working class people, so you might as well not try. There's a lot in Ricardo to object to. If you actually dig into all the economic theories and the constructs that are supposedly given to us to prove that free trade is always our best move under all circumstances, That just isn't true. That's just not what these ideas actually say if you dig into them.
Well, that leads into my next question. You know, you've taken Econ 101. I've taken Econ 101. Everyone who has is familiar with the theory of comparative advantage and the example that Ricardo provided using the cloth and wine trade between Portugal and England. But how has it persisted and remained dominant so long, considering that it contains, as you noted, no less than 7 dubious assumptions?
Well, the theory of comparative advantage, which basically comes down to the idea that nations trade for the same reasons people do, and the reason that you buy your coffee in the coffee shop rather than making it for yourself is not that you can't make it for yourself. It's not even that you might not even be more efficient at making yourself than the guy in the coffee shop. It's just that you have other things to do with your time. And you fully elaborate that. You can understand why it's advantageous not just to import products, but to import products for nations that are less efficient producers than we are. I mean, we import a huge quantity of goods from China. China is not a more efficient industrial machine than the United States. In fact, by any of the standard measures, they're much less efficient. Now, the problem with the theory of comparative advantage is that although it does tell you a lot of good things, which are true, and it's a useful analytical construct for dealing with a lot of economic realities, it was never intended by its own inventor, and its own intrinsic logic will not support its being turned into a blank check for 100% free trade with 100% of the world 100% of the time. That's just not what the theory actually says, as opposed to what the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and multinational corporations attempting to corrupt the Congress with direct and indirect bribery would like you to believe that it says.
But why has it persisted and been so dominant for so long, considering that not only does it have those 7 dubious assumptions, but that it's quite clear that it can't possibly be applied in the manner that it usually is applied?
Because it is advantageous to powerful special interests. That's the main reason. I mean, it gives the answer that these guys want to hear, which is that America should practice free trade towards the rest of the world, which means that multinational corporate interests can produce in China, lay off their American workforce, bring those goods to the United States, and sell them here at an enormous profit that you can get when you're using slave labor. There's no secret. The subsidiary reason why the theory has remained more popular than it deserves to be is it gratifies the desire of academic economists to have one simple formula that explains the whole world. I mean, if
sure.
you dealt with academics, it's a beautiful ivory tower construct, because once you master the mathematics of this one simple formula, you've got a magic wand that tells you just about everything about international trade without your even needing to consult any empirical facts or statistics on the matter, let alone actually visit a factory or a dockyard or a shop to see what's really going on.
When you mentioned multinationals, it reminded me of a question that I was actually planning to ask you later, but we'll go ahead and jump in and throw it at you now. One aspect of the trade issue that I haven't seen much discussed is the dichotomy between the language of free trade and the observable reality. You know, we talk a lot about human freedom. We talk about the known inefficiencies of government intervention in the economy, which is relevant since we're talking about trade barriers at the national level. You have to involve the government. But the overwhelming majority of trade, free or otherwise, is taking place between corporations, which are obviously government-created, government-regulated organizations.
I got 2 points for you here. The first thing is that multinational corporations have no loyalty to the United States. This is something that people on the political left in this country pretty much instinctively understand, but there's a real problem with people who are right of center that they still think we're living in the 1950s and what's good for General Motors is good for America. This is flatly not the case. And if you go read the annual reports of these own companies, so this is what they say about themselves, not what I say about them. A lot of them are very explicit about the fact that they have no particular commitment to any country at all, and that means they have no commitment to the United States. Now, the second point is that you're very correct that free trade needs scare quotes around the word free. There is no real free trade in the world today. What you have is unilateral free trade being practiced by the United States. Now, in my book, Free Trade Doesn't Work, which is available on Amazon, by the way, I said that my estimate is that trade into the United States, that is imports, is probably about 98-99% free. That is to say, our trade barriers are 1 or 2% of the value of our trade.
I'm surprised it's even that high.
That's well below the profit margins or even the volatility in currencies. So trade into the United States is pretty much free. The problem is going the other direction, that is exporting American goods to foreign countries. Almost all foreign countries of any significance have very profound trade barriers. Now, that, of course, is why you end up with the U.S. running a trade deficit fluctuating around $500 billion a year. And the important thing to understand is that most of these foreign trade barriers are not out in the open.
Right.
Some countries have explicit tariffs. They still do. But American capitalism is relatively unique in the world in the sense of being a fairly freewheeling and open system in which if you come to the market with a better product at a lower price, then that's what people will buy. Most of the world is a much clubbier, more government-dominated or special interest-dominated system in which, for example, in Europe, as a product of their history, there's kind of a social contract between big business and big government and labor in which we allow you to have a capitalist economy on the condition that you split part of the take with us. And part of the deal is that you don't buy from or import foreign goods beyond a certain level that we think is appropriate. For example, in Germany, if BMW were to say, okay, we're going to think about instead of getting the tires for our cars from Continental Tire, which is a German company, but get them from, say, Goodyear in the United States, they would discover that their bank is also the same bank as the company they're buying the tires from. And banks are much more powerful in Germany. They have much smaller stock market relative to their banks than we do. So basically, they would be told, if you know what's good for you and you ever expect us to lend you any more money ever again, you'll buy your tires from the people that we lend money to, because if you don't, they'll go broke and we won't get our money back. Now, that's just one very simple example.
It's like a German version of the keiretsu in Japan.
Yeah, it is. That's another example. The Japanese have perhaps the most baroquely elaborate system. They have these vast conglomerates called the keiretsu. In Korea, they're called the chaebol. And there are enormous differences between one country to another. But the fundamental thing to understand is in most of the world, capitalism is a much clubbier set of arrangements. And one of the deals that's made between companies and between companies and the government and between companies and labor and so forth in these countries is that you keep out American products beyond a certain level that they're prepared to accept.
Sure.
So that's why American exports are not doing well relative to the enormous volume of our imports, and neither the Obama administration nor the Republicans seem to have any idea what game is being played here. They just keep pushing for more free trade agreements, which are basically these paper agreements, which we have no ability to enforce, which we don't even try to enforce, and which most of the world understands are polite fiction. They're not real descriptions of actually opening up the market to the trading part.
Voxic Shock will be right back. WND Books presents Jerome Corsi's New York Times and Amazon bestseller, Where's the Birth Certificate?
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
So help you God.
So help me God.
How can you preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States if, as running for president, you haven't even established you meet the eligibility requirements of being a natural-born citizen? Presidents who try to cover up are doing so at their own detriment. As long as they're secrets, as long as they're covered up, the American people will not have the truth. Americans need to know what's in this book.
Jerome Corsi's Where's the Birth Certificate? Now back to Vox Day and Ian Fletcher on Voxic Shock.
Let's move away from trade for a moment. You studied economics at the University of Chicago, and you mentioned the brilliant work that Friedman did in debunking the Keynesian consensus. How would you describe your own approach to economics now? Are you a classic Chicago school monetarist, or more of a post-Keynesian like Krugman or Stiglitz?
I have to describe myself in economics as a dissident. I mean, I get very little respect from anybody in the mainstream of the American profession, which is about 90% in favor of free trade, though that's gradually shifting. The only places I've ever been able to get my work published are dissident journals. And the fact is, the American economics profession, if you've been paying any attention, is in a state of enormous crisis right now. These
Absolutely.
Are the guys who told us before the 2008 financial crisis that our financial system was fine. They added an academic gloss to these ridiculous claims coming out of Wall Street that there was never going to be another financial crisis because we had derivatives and all this fancy mathematical computerized stuff that now we don't need the kind of regulations that they swept away, for example, when they repealed Glass-Steagall Act in 1999. So these are the guys I'm going up against. All I can say is that their track record is not that good.
No, I'm down with you on that. You know, I wrote a book called The Return of the Great Depression that was published on the anniversary of Black Tuesday about 2 years ago. And for the first, I don't know, 9 months, people would say, hey, you know, where's this depression? You know, it's a recovery. And the academics do not have a good record. But based on what I've read in the book, you still tend to come a little bit more from the Chicago school than, say, from the Austrian school, much less the Keynesian school.
Well, what I'm prepared to say is that I'm prepared to take the free market as a starting point. That is, when you analyze the economy, if you're honest about it, you can't have the free market as a description of how 100% of the economy works or as how 100% of it should work. But you do take it as your starting point, and then you say, okay, if there are certain parts of the economy that don't function according to free market principles, or they don't function well according to those principles, then we're going to say, okay, you've got to have some other kind of analysis. So we're not going to have absolute laissez-faire in financial markets, because there are demonstrable reasons why financial markets, as opposed to product markets, tend to produce volatility and tend to produce cycles of boom and bust, of speculative excess and crash. And then you look at international trade and you say, okay, when you have international trade, it's not the same kind of commercial relationship as when you go down to a corner grocery store and buy a loaf of bread. So there are reasons why free trade, which is what the free market implication would be, why that is wrong. I'm not a socialist or anything. I have no particular love of regulation for its own sake. But you do have to pull back from the pure 100% laissez-faire model of the world if you're going to have an accurate description of it. You just do.
You mentioned that you're a dissident as far as the academics are concerned. What has been the response in the economic community to it? Are they mostly trying to ignore it, or are they trying to actively attack it?
You know, it's very interesting. For the most part, academics are a very involuted, inbred bunch who are only interested in reading other academics within very narrow specialties that they inhabit. So for the most part, yeah, Joe Academic has kind of ignored my work. I have, however, had a very positive response. If you look at the blurbs I got from my book, I had some very high-ranking people praising my work, and I'm in correspondence with quite significant scholars. Your listeners probably wouldn't recognize their names, but there are people here and there who are well aware of the fact that the present economic consensus is a mess, and they're looking for ways out of the bottle. And gradually they will find it, but I suspect that crisis will come long before academics figure out what's going on and that they're... No, I think the academics will do a good job of rationalizing what has happened after we solve these problems. And I'm quite sure that 30 years from now, they will probably teach reasonable doctrine about these matters, but I don't expect the solution...
And how it could have been avoided.
Yeah, but I don't expect the solution to come out of the academy the way you could get a cure for cancer come out of a lab.
Talking about some of the solutions, let's look at the actual numbers. You know, the BEA came out with their quarterly report just a few days ago, and just substituting domestic production for the $2.6 trillion in current imports would increase GDP to $17.6 trillion. Now, the counter argument, of course, is that, well, we would lose all of the $2 trillion we have in exports if we were to institute a trade war. First of all, is that even true? And secondly, since the negative balance of trade is around 30% of exports, it's about $600 billion, Where is the risk in raising trade barriers for a large, wealthy country that has a huge trade deficit? I mean, even if tariffs eliminated all demand for U.S. exports, we'd still be looking at 2 to 3 times more growth than the BEA is presently reporting.
Yeah, you're making a very good point. There's an economist called William Barr, I know, who's estimated the U.S. economy is probably about 13% smaller than it would be if we hadn't been running trade deficits since 1976. That's huge.
Wow.
That is,
yeah, that's massive.
If we had an economy 13% bigger than it is, we wouldn't be having these horrible budget fights and so forth. I mean, that's a hole bigger than the entire economy of Canada. Now, you talk about what would happen if you had domestic production of all the goods we import. The way you've got to think about this is Americans produce a certain amount of goods. They consume a certain amount of goods. And the difference between that, if you consume more than you produce, that's your trade deficit, because if you're consuming goods and you didn't make them yourself, well, somebody had to make them, and foreign countries is the only place they can come from, given that there is no Santa Claus and it's not being made by Santa's elves. As a result, if you're going to, say, replace that gap between what you produce and what you consume, you're talking about either increasing your production or reducing your consumption. Now, there's a lot of complications here. Just you ignore that. And I'm going to say that a reasonable assumption, this isn't necessarily what happens, but the reasonable assumption to make is if you did rebalance America's trade, it wouldn't be purely by increasing our production, and it wouldn't be purely by reducing our consumption. It would probably be about a little bit of both. Among other things, we can't overnight create all the industrial plants which used to produce the products that we now import. There are no cell phone factories in the United States. There are no light bulb factories in the United States. There are no suitcase factories in the United States. So those things can't suddenly start being produced domestically overnight. But over time, it can. And some of the goods we import, we are capable of producing domestically. So what I'm basically saying is that your suggestion there is a very good one. That is, if we were producing more of these goods for ourselves, we would have a larger domestic production, larger GDP, probably lower unemployment. Now, the second question that you raised was the idea of a trade war, which is basically, okay, suppose that we've decided that this outcome of Americans producing more goods for themselves is a good thing. How do you make that come about? Now, a trade war basically means you tell foreign countries, if you're not going to import our goods, well, then we're not going to import yours. And a trade war is talked about by most conventional thinkers on the subject in the major media and so forth, like it's this terrible catastrophe. Now, the first question I have to ask for people who are indulging in doomsday talk about a trade war is, please give me one single historical example of a trade war. There isn't any.
Well, typically they cite the Smoot-Hawley tariff, but that's a ridiculous example because the amount of trade that declined was actually smaller than it had declined about 6 years before when there was no tariff. And secondly, within 4 or 5 years after that, they switched from running a surplus to a deficit. There's absolutely no possible way that the effect of Smoot-Hawley could have really had anything to do with the Great Depression. And I've noticed that the people who used to bring that up are starting to move away from it a little bit. But that's the only example I've ever heard, and it's inaccurate.
Yeah, it's an interesting point you would make. For those listeners who aren't familiar, the United States passed a tariff in 1929, went into effect in 1930. It's called the Smoot-Hawley tariff that some people blame either for the Great Depression or for spreading the Great Depression around the world. Now, in point of fact, this is not a hypothesis which is believed in even by free traders who know any economic history. For example, Milton Friedman, the famous Milton Friedman, was a big exponent of free markets. He's a big free trader. But he himself said in one of his books that the idea that Smoot-Hawley was the cause of the Great Depression or the spread of the Great Depression around the world is nonsense. And the difference between Milton Friedman and most free trade economists is that Milton Friedman is actually an economic historian, which very few economists these days are. They're mostly just theorists who don't have any interest in data outside the last 5 years. Milton Friedman was actually an economic historian, among other things. He wrote the standard economic history of the American money supply. And that was a fascinating topic for you. And as a result, I have the authority of even one of the leading free traders on this question that the whole Smoot-Hawley thing is just nonsense. Among other things, the increases in American tariffs were more than compensated for by the collapse in the value of a lot of foreign currencies. So, yeah, any number of ways you want to look at it, it just does not pan out. So I'm not especially afraid of a trade war. The other thing I would point out is the United States is already in a trade war with countries like China that are deliberately using aggressive mercantilist tactics to benefit themselves at our expense. The difference is, I think if we're in a trade war, we should be fighting back.
I concur. I mean, I was actually extremely worried. You know, I'm a World of Warcraft player, and it's obviously very upsetting when you find out that they've got Chinese labor camp prisoners who are being forced to play World of Warcraft in order to generate virtual money. Clearly, the only thing that America can do is draft young men to start playing more massive multiplayer online games so that we don't, you know, lose out on the slave labor providing fake money to people who don't have the time to play games. We don't want to lose that to China.
How anybody thinks we can or should engage in free trade with a country that uses slave labor is completely beyond me.
Exactly. Now, free trade proponents often point to the transition from horses to automobiles when they discuss the problem of Americans losing their jobs as various industries move their manufacturing overseas. Do you find the buggy whip analogy to be a relevant one? And if so, what are these new industries that are replacing the ones being moved offshore? It seems to me that most of the jobs growth in the last decade, to the extent there has been any, has been in sectors like real estate and government, neither of which are usually considered to be a sound foundation for long-term economic growth.
The problem with the logic of the people that you're talking to is that they're assuming that the inexorable replacement of yesterday's jobs by tomorrow's jobs and the emergence of new industries that are rising to replace jobs in old industries that are declining, they're presuming that that process is completely automatic and guaranteed to happen no matter what. Now, if you dig into the economic logic of it, it is simply not true that that will happen if you run a massive trade deficit, because in order to create new jobs in, say, making electric cars or iPhones or whatever, you have to be producing those yourself. You can't just be importing them. Otherwise, the jobs that are created in these new industries are abroad. They're not here.
Absolutely. And if you don't build up the expertise, if you don't build up the infrastructure at the first level, you know, in the first generation, how on earth are you going to be able to compete in the second, third, and fourth generations?
Yeah, it's very important to understand the United States is not just competing in an international free market. We're competing with foreign countries that have very aggressive government support for their industrial base. So if you look at, I get this complaint from companies that belong to the organization I work for, which, by the way, is called the Coalition for Prosperous America, and our website is at prosperousamerica.org. One of the biggest complaints that brings companies to our organization is that when they figure out they're not just competing with foreign companies, they're competing with entire foreign countries.
That does make it a little bit difficult. One last question. The fundamental message of the book is to advocate strategic rather than unconditional integration. How do you define the difference between the two, and what are the benefits of a strategic approach versus the costs of an unconditional one?
Yeah, what I said in the book is that what the United States needs is a strategic rather than unconditional integration with the rest of the world economy. Now, the free trade philosophy, which also goes along with a lot of other things like free international movement of capital, basically says that because free markets are an accurate description of 100% of how the world economy works or close to it, and because free markets are guaranteed to give you the best result 100% of the time or close to it, I'm not going to pick nits over 1% or 2%, therefore, we should just throw our economy open to the rest of the world, and this guarantees that we get the best possible result. Now, what I'm saying is this is not true, and I like free markets, but they're not 100% of the story. They never have been, and they never will be. So we do have to exercise a certain faculty of picking and choosing in this country of who and what we will do business with. Now, what I suggested in the book is a flat tariff of, say, 25-30% on all American imports. The first thing that would do is it would probably rebalance our trade, because when we run a trade deficit, not only do we destroy jobs here, but every year that goes by, we accumulate debt to foreign countries and we sell off our existing assets to them. There's a lot of sophistry spoken about the trade deficit. The number one thing you have to remember is very simple. The trade deficit is real money. It's not an accounting abstraction, as one crazy libertarian economist recently referred to it as. Now, the other thing that I would advocate about a flat tariff is a flat tariff, if you have, say, a 30% tariff on all imports, that's not going to bring back to the United States industries like sewing T-shirts together, because these industries are mostly based on cheap labor. Labor in the United States is not cheap. And as a result, these goods would probably still be produced abroad, but it would tend to bring back to the United States industries like, for example, the manufacture of flat panel displays. Right now, there's no civilian flat panel display manufacturing in the United States, and yet this is not some low-tech buggy whip industry that we ought to have progressed beyond. It is, in point of fact, a very high-tech, highly capitalized, high productivity, and thus high-wage industry. And if you had a flat tariff, you would tend to bring back those industries to the United States.
Well, yeah, the fact that all the iPods and iPads and the latest consumer electronics are all being manufactured elsewhere, they may be designed here, but when they're not being manufactured here, we're losing out on the ability to produce the next generation. And so it's impossible to resort to the buggy whip thing, because obviously iPads are not outmoded.
Yeah, the thing to understand about something like the iPhone, it's actually a product been studied pretty thoroughly in this regard, is you have to distinguish between final assembly and component manufacture.
In your book, you point out that Japan actually provides a tremendous amount of the more difficult stuff that goes into the iPad, correct?
Yeah, you have to remember that when you see made in China on the outside of a product, that usually just means the final assembly of the product from a kit of parts took place in China with large quantities of relatively unskilled labor. I'm not particularly worried that the final kit assembly of the iPhone may be taking place in Guangdong province. What bothers me is that things like the computer chips that go into it, the backlit digital flat panel display that it has, these things are being made in other high-wage countries like Japan, Singapore, and intermediate-wage countries like Korea, which pay less than the United States, but they're by no means poor countries like China. Those are the kind of jobs that we should be capturing, and we're not. There's no good reason for that.
Right. Well, Ian Fletcher, thank you so much. Your book, Free Trade Doesn't Work, is brilliant, and I'm always excited when I see one of your columns pop up on WorldNet Daily.
Well, thank you very much. Anybody who's interested in a further look can see my website, which is at freetradedoesn'twork.com.
You've been listening to Voxic Shock. Until next time, enjoy your depression. Audio production on Voxic Shock by GoodmanShow.com. Revolutionary audio.